The Great Library of Alexandria was a nexus of the old world. Alexander the Great's empire was as much a campaign of epistemological conquest as it was territorial. Upon defeating the Achaemenid Empire, Alexander's generals gained access to the libraries of Susa, Babylon, and Persepolis, where thousands of cuneiform tablets chronicled advanced systems of hydrology, astronomy, metallurgy, and medicine. Under the Ptolemies, the Library of Alexandria became the greatest synthesis hub of ancient information in the world. Egyptian high priests who guarded traditions from the pre-dynastic age were incentivized or coerced into sharing materials. These included writings from the House of the Phoenix, a temple complex said to preserve the teachings of Thoth, associated with Atlantean wisdom and antediluvian memory. Aristotle himself, a collector of foreign manuscripts, had his students transcribe forbidden alchemical texts that were later cited in medieval Arabic grimoires. Rome's militaristic campaigns often involved deliberate looting of intellectual capital. After the siege of Syracuse in 212 BC, the Roman general Marcellus seized not just spoils, but Archimedes' secret engineering manuscripts, rumored to include heat ray designs and advanced hydraulics. These were locked away for senatorial eyes only, once again mirroring the modern examples we have today of classified research, special access programs. The same thing was happening in the ancient past. Similarly, during the 70 CE destruction of the Second Temple of Jerusalem, Roman forces under Titus confiscated sacred scrolls and archives, and some accounts suggest that they were hidden in the tabularium, accessible only to the Flavian elite. This act may have constituted one of the largest single seizures of pre-monotheistic mystical knowledge in history. Seneca the Younger alluded to such secrets in Naturalis Questionis, where he cryptically claimed that celestial arts are the inheritance of noble bloodlines. While Julius Caesar's siege in 48 BC did destroy a portion of the Great Library of Alexandria, subsequent purges were far more deliberate. The Theodosian decrees in 391 CE, which banned pagan worship, culminated in the razing of the Serapeum, the library's philosophical annex. Bishop Theophilus of Alexandria oversaw the destruction of what many claim to be a repository of pre-Adamite civilization records, including scrolls tracing human history back hundreds of thousands of years. This eradication was more than religious, it was epistemological warfare. Following Constantine's adoption of Christianity, early church fathers such as Augustine redefined ancient esoteric sciences as demonic distortions. In De Civitate Dei, Augustine denounced the Nephilim, the sons of God from Genesis 6, as deceivers teaching fallen knowledge. At the Council of Nicaea, 325 CE, texts like Berossus' Biblionica were suppressed due to their descriptions of pre-flood kings ruling for 432,000 years, a time frame aligning with Sumerian king lists and Hindu Yuga cycles. This kind of suppression reveals a consistent pattern. Ancient texts that challenge biblical chronology or offer technological marvels are rendered apocryphal or heretical. Which brings us to the modern day, where this issue persists and the secreting away of incredibly important historical information and artifacts is represented in no grander and more disturbing form than the Vatican Church and its apostolic archives, a veritable fortress of forbidden knowledge. Founded in 1612, the Vatican Apostolic Archives is home to over 53 miles worth of shelving, in order to hold all of the knowledge that the Holy See has sequestered away over the centuries, and is not available in its full form to the public. It is not even available in its full form to scholars. You need to be a specific scholar within a specific discipline, and then you can make a specific request for a specific piece of information. You may be provided that information, but you are not provided anything outside of your requests. This is how the intelligence community operates with classified programs, silos and stovepipes, compartmented intelligence, special access programs. This is the same behavior being exhibited by the Vatican in relation to our own history. The Index Librorum Prohibitorum, which is Latin for List of Prohibited Books, was a powerful tool of ecclesiastical censorship used by the Catholic Church to suppress writings it deemed heretical, blasphemous, immoral, or otherwise dangerous to the faith and the authority of the Church. It was first issued in 1559, and it was updated regularly all the way up until its abolishment in 1966, by which point, of course, the damage to the expansion of knowledge for the masses had very much been done already. And this suppression of knowledge is almost always done, especially when it is done by the Church, to benefit you, to help you, to assist you on your spiritual journey, to protect you from heresy. But one man's heresy is another man's destiny. The mysticism, the occultism, the esoterica, the scientific ideas, the philosophical ideas, all branded as demonic or evil, heretical. This is a direct sabotage on human ingenuity, on creativity, on our natural abilities, our origins, our birthright, our future. And that is why we must revisit the past, because our knowledge, or lack thereof, could have significant consequences for where humanity goes in the future. The myth of the flood, the Great Flood, is almost universal. Cultures from the Americas to Mesopotamia to the Pacific Islands all speak of a global deluge, a moment when an older world was wiped clean. And we find remarkably consistent accounts globally of a cataclysmic flood, often accompanied by cosmic or seismic upheavals, and are always followed by a rebuilding of civilization, often with external guidance from powerful figures who emerge and bring to the people their civilization-building knowledge. These are not isolated stories. They are a global pattern, stretching from the Andes to the Himalayas, from tribal oral traditions to ancient epics that are etched in stone. For example, one of the earliest known flood myths written down comes from Mesopotamia, which we now know as the region of Iraq and Syria. The Epic of Gilgamesh, where the Sumerian god Enlil sends a flood to destroy mankind. And within this epic, you then have Atrahasis, who is a Noah-type figure, who is instructed to build a boat and save animals and humans. The text also mentions multiple prior civilizations that were wiped out by floods and other catastrophes, which implies a cycle of destruction and rebirth that has played out across the eons, which is another claim that is echoed across ancient cultures worldwide. Then you have the Satya Yuga flood myths from the Vedic texts of ancient India. In the Shatapatha Brahmana, it tells of a great flood, foretold to a figure named Manu, who is warned by a deity called Vishnu or Matsya. Manu builds a boat to rescue the sages and the sacred knowledge from the coming destruction, and then after the flood, Manu is told to rebuild the world, with guidance from beings who are associated with maintaining the cosmic order. We have stories from the Aztec and the Mayan traditions of ancient Mesoamerica. The Aztec codices describe several previous suns or ages of man, each destroyed by a different catastrophe, one of which was a massive flood. The Popol Vuh, which is a sacred Mayan text, recounts how humanity was recreated multiple times after great floods and fire from the sky. Each cycle ended in destruction, but between these cycles, spiritual deities and teachers would emerge and re-educate humanity in the ways of agriculture, astronomy, timekeeping, all of the necessary elements needed to bring humanity back from the brink. In ancient Greek mythology, Zeus floods the earth to punish humanity. Polynesian cultures speak of a great wave and rising seas that drowned the ancient lands. Why we discount so many instances of the same story across culture is nonsensical. What interests me the most is what preceded the floods. What was before all of this destruction? Well, the Sumerian and Egyptian accounts speak of the antediluvian kings who ruled for thousands of years, figures of immense wisdom, of cosmic knowledge, builders of vast stone structures. In Egyptian records, like those kept by the priest Manetho, he speaks of the time of the Shemsu-Hor, the time of the followers of Horus, who he says predated the dynastic pharaohs and were said to have built great works of stone. Then, of course, you have Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, the oldest megalithic site in the world, and one that mainstream archaeology would have us believe to be the start of civilization. but it seems more like the restarting of civilization to me. With evidence of organized labor and advanced astronomical knowledge suddenly popping up seemingly out of nowhere, there is no evidence of a gradual progression up towards a site like Göbekli Tepe. It just appears in an area associated typically with hunter-gatherer communities. So the idea that these hunter-gatherers put down their spears one day, climbed out of their deerhide tents and began constructing multi-ton stone building projects with precision cosmic and geodetic alignment, crafting with precision some of the hardest stones on the planet, during a period of time that, according to our completely broken and inept models for history, predates the use of even copper and bronze tools, predates the invention of the wheel, and predates essentially all markers of civilizational development. The Stone Age, the Neolithic Age, an age where we are taught we are a rudimentary, basic, primal people. A very basic form of humanity. Suddenly out of nowhere during this time period, we start making Stonehenge, Göbekli Tepe, Newgrange, the Hypogeum. It makes absolutely no sense. For quite a few years now, I've been looking at archaeology, archaeoastronomy, quantum physics, acoustics, mythology, and consciousness studies, and exploring the possibility that a highly advanced civilization once existed on Earth. The level of geometric exactitude, celestial alignment, vibration-sensitive engineering, all demonstrates an awareness of Earth's subtle energetic anatomy, what we might now call planetary bioelectromagnetism. We have the extremely advanced evidence left behind. We have the shattered remains of incredible temples and structures that defy our conventional models. And so why do we so quickly dismiss the indigenous histories when they are also backed up by architectural anomalies that we cannot explain? Deep within the fortified halls of sacred orders and institutions of global influence that have a vested interest in maintaining particular narratives, protecting their flock from disruptive possibilities. The implications of our true history is a powerful arena of human psychology, and the implications of disclosing information that calls into question the very systems and models that we've established to explain not only our worldly existence, but our spiritual existence. So much hangs in the balance for those who are responsible for curating and maintaining a particular status quo, an entrenched belief system. This cup and the technology and techniques presented within it predate modern nanotechnology by 1,600 years. They couldn't replicate it through the processes and the materials used by the ancient Romans. We still had to fake it to make it.